Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
This is a crowd podcast.
We Didn't Start the Fire, the only podcast started by me, Billy Joel.
Wheel of Fortune,
Sally Ride,
Heavy Metal Suicide,
Foreign Debts,
Homeless Vets,
AIDS,
Crack,
Bernie Gets,
Hypodermics on the Shore,
China's Under Martial Law,
Rock and Roll and Cola Wars,
I can't take it anymore! Well, actually, I can take it.
One more episode, Katie.
Okay, I can do it.
Hello and welcome to episode 120 of We Didn't Start the Fire. I pause here. Katie, drumroll please. Because, Katie,
yes,
as it stands, this is currently our final ever episode of the podcast. That is a number one song. That's a skip and a trip round the story of the post-war world. Katie, our guru has been Billy Joel.
Yes.
Our mission has been to feed our heads.
Yes.
And our pledge has been that together we will learn without ever feeling like we're ever really learning. I am Tom Fordyce.
I'm still Katie Puckrick.
Katie, shall we toast our lobes one more time around the fire?
Oh, I feel so sad. I mean, this topic today, Rock and Roll Cola Wars, I'm not sure if it has the kind of gravitas of, China's Under Martial Law.
Or an Eisenhower.
AIDS, Moonshot.
Charles de Gaulle.
It sort of reminds me of, like, this is how we're going out, we're discussing some advertising strategy of soft drinks, and it reminds me a little bit of the time that I thought I was going to die in Crete on holiday, and I felt like this was such a silly way to go. I was caught in a riptide, and I just thought, this is a little pathetic, and I felt a little shy about waving to my friends on the beach, and I was about to just submit to the inevitable death when I finally found a little sort of a literal lifeline. And I crawled my way into the shore. But what I mean is, it just seems like after this big buildup, is that all there is? We're just going to end on a damp squib. But I bet it's not a damp squib.
Never is a damp squib with us, Katie. And I think when I first looked at this line, I was like, is this one lyric? Is it two? Is rock and roll about a film, which it can't be because that came out much later? And then we've done a little bit of research, and it is Pepsi against Coke. And it is weaponizing the big stars of the day.
It's weaponizing the big stars of the day. And after feeling a little meh about the topic, I'm now actually very invested. One thing is, Tom, I realized I don't really know the difference between Coke and Pepsi.
Well, you have a treat in store, Katie, because
yes?
Our beloved producer, Fionn, has put two different glasses of dark fizzy liquid in front of both of us. Because I believe, Fionn, we're about to try our very own Pepsi challenge.
Okay, so I'm reaching for the glass on my left.
Okay, I don't know if Fionn has mixed this up. I will also go for the glass on my left. I'm going to give it a quick nose.
Okay.
That instantly takes me back to being 9 years old at my granny's.
It smells like clean.
It lasts up my head. It's one of these beverages.
It's like a cleaning fluid. Okay, let's see.
That's so fizzy.
It's...
Whoa, it's so sweet.
It sort of has... sort of a distinct flavor of nothingness. Like, I don't really know how you'd characterize it.
It disappears on your tongue very quickly, doesn't it?
Okay, maybe.
Number two. So this is simply which one we prefer.
I think I like the one on the right more. They're both sweet.
I think I know the difference as well, even though I've drunk neither for 30 years.
It's a little more flaccid somehow. And the one on the right has a little more body to it. So they're both similar, But I do prefer the one on the right. And do we know which is which?
So you're going right.
I'm going right.
I am saying left, Fionn. Which way has this gone?
So before I tell you, which one do you think is Pepsi versus Coke?
I think Pepsi's right-hand side and I think Coke is left.
I think that Pepsi is on the left-hand side and I think Coke is on the right-hand side.
Can Fionn remember? Remember!
Okay, so Tommy, you picked...
Coke on the left, yeah. Pepsi on the right. I prefer the one on the left.
You are correct. You are correct.
Apparently I love Pepsi.
What did you, which
I,
one?
Oh, I picked the one on the right.
Yeah, that is your Pepsi.
Oh, I like Pepsi.
Which one, did you think that was Pepsi?
I thought it was Coke.
Wait, let me double check.
The one on the right.
The one on the right has more bubbles to
it. I'll be able to taste.
Wait.
I'll be able to taste it. I think that's Pepsi. Let me try that one.
Okay.
So that's the one on the right-hand side.
You know, this is like when you say a word over and over and over again and it loses all meaning.
That's the Coke.
Oh, I like Pepsi.
I think the error I made was your big glass was Pepsi.
I thought that was deliberate.
And your big glass was Coke. But then I think you drank so much of your Pepsi that it's down the glass. But you like Pepsi, you like Coke.
Well, you know what? The Pepsi challenge. I took it and Pepsi and I triumphed.
And overall for We Didn't Start the Fire, Katie, it's a score draw.
Does this mean I'm going to have to fight you in the street, Tom Fordyce?
I think so, with fists.
It's going to get ugly. It's going to get very ugly. Okay, so let's bring in an expert on this matter. This is the Rock and Roller Cola Wars, and to be the referee, we have wheeled in the director at Columbia Business School's Center on Global Brand Leadership. He is Matthew Quint, welcome.
Thank you, Katie. Thank you, Tom. No pressure here, right? Last show of the whole podcast series.
Yes, I know. Okay, well, let's just ignore that. And let's just zero in on what the heck does Billy mean by Rock and Roller Cola Wars? It sounds to me like a little bit of a dance-off.
Both brands at the time in the 80s, leading up to, you know, the song coming out at the end of the decade, were both using music artists. I mean, it's interesting he used rock and roller because at the time, Coca-Cola, primarily for Diet Coke, was using folks like Ray Charles and Aretha Franklin.
Really?
And Pepsi is known, and you probably do have the memory of, you know, Michael Jackson, Paula Abdul, Britney Spears, right? So it's interesting, right? Rock and Roller Cola Wars. But if you look, it's sort of R&B and pop. Musicians were generally the ones feeding those advertisements that we may remember from the 1980s and were hot at the time that the song came out.
I've got a feeling, Casey, the rock and roller is simply to rhyme with cola.
It trips off the tongue. And I'm wondering, Matt, why are pop stars suddenly purveyors of soda pop in the 1980s?
What's so interesting, Katie, is that Coca-Cola began using music stars back in the 60s.
Ah.
They were working with McCann Erickson, their advertising company. Bill Backer is sort of an icon in the industry, and he tied in the idea of young music, sodas in general, and we'll talk about this more, sort of usually target a younger audience in their advertising and promotions kind of work. So we are talking about, in the 1960s, bands like The Supremes, Aretha Franklin, Marvin Gaye, Ray Charles, The Who, The Four Seasons, The Everly Brothers, Roy Orbison, all of those bands adapted the slogan for Coke, "Things Go Better with Coke," and did short spots, but also songs. Some of them made the top 10 Billboard.
I'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony.
That was what, 1969 or 1970? That famous
71.
71, that famous Coke ad came out.
Which also hit the Billboard top 10 when it came out.
And so tell us about that ad, because I think that was something that even people who weren't alive then remember. You weren't alive, Tom.
No, but
right?
I remember Oasis ripping it off for Shaker Maker.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So Matt, talk us through that ad. What did we see? What did we hear?
Yeah. So that came out of both these brands, Coca-Cola more strongly, a total global presence, right? 100 to 200 countries, right? Exactly. All around the world. So that spun out of kind of this ethos of, you know, the 60s and Vietnam War and, you know, in the United States, you know, the challenges of civil rights and all these kind of things. And again, still stemming off this music theme that Coke had been on in the 60s, they also did some of their own additional advertising with songs that they developed. And this sort of spun out once again with McCann Erickson as a unique song. It's actually, the story goes that Bill Backer, this accountant at McCann, was on a flight delay in Ireland, and is his recalling of the story. And he was watching folks in the airport, you know, of all kinds, kind of drinking Coca-Cola in this social situation, and had these familiar words, "Let's have a Coke," which was the sort of phrasing he was using at the time, as, you know, a subtle, as he calls it, a subtle way of saying, "Let's keep each other company for a little while." And that spun into the lyrical formation in his mind, and eventually that song, which again was sent out as an advertisement, but fans, radio listeners began requesting from DJs at the time to keep playing,
ad? That's a dream come true for those Coke executives. And then can you tell us about what we saw in this iconic television advertisement?
Yes, so they got people of all races, creeds, colors, right, onto a hill in Italy. It's interesting, it's this peace and love, but my faculty director here at Columbia, Baron Schmidt, also says it looks kind of like they're in military formation simultaneously with the way they're arrayed on the hilltop. So that was, again, right, Coca-Cola trying to get into the ethos of the time.
Do you know what I found myself wondering, Katie, after our taste challenge, with the taste of two colas still glued to our teeth and our tongues, I found myself thinking what strange beverages they are.
It's just such a weird beverage. I mean, it's not recognizably a flavor that occurs in the natural world. And that makes me wonder, Matt, both these drinks were created in the late 1880s. And supposedly it's a sort of a vague cocktail of lemon and coriander, nutmeg, cinnamon. Do you have any, would you hazard a guess on what it's based on? Or was it just an entirely new invention? Or were olden days people wearing bustles and corsets enjoying these strange, abstruse beverages?
Well, it's an interesting question. It really ties into the creation of these drinks being by chemists and pharmacists. So they're health tonics. Yeah. They were, which were these sort of mixture of sweet things and drugs, essentially, right? So that the story goes that John Pemberton, who is the originator of Coca-Cola, the first of the two, was taken by a drink that had become popular in Europe, particularly, and then over in the United States, called Vin Mariani, developed by the inventor Angelo Mariani, also a chemist, who took a Bordeaux and incorporated cocoa leaves into the production of it, which created cocaine. So it had this energy, refreshing thing. Reportedly, the Pope at the time was a fan and did an endorsement of Vin Mariani. And so supposedly Pemberton first developed an alcoholic adaptation where he also incorporated the cola nut, which had also been growing in the 19th century as a caffeine-oriented material to put in things to give that caffeine boost, which was sweeter in its underlying flavor than, you know, coffee or tea at the time. So these kind of sweet. So he combined essentially that coca and cola together, yes, into this syrupy drink. Caleb Bradham is the 2 years later in 1888 developed Pepsi Cola. He used Pepsin, was his unique element mixed with the cola. He did not have
coca.
And
what is Pepsin? What is Pepsin?
It's interestingly a digestive enzyme,
wow,
but yes.
I mean, basically, all of these are glorified speedballs. They're like puppy uppers and doggy downers. You knock it back and it slows your roll, but it gives you a little lust for life at the same time.
And they were spun out of both these being chemists and pharmacists, right? The soda fountain. Right. That was where their products and their livelihoods was spent, in a pharmacy,
which at the time
had these syrups that were poured into a glass, of which then carbonated water was poured into it, and they were stirred together and you drank it. And so that ethos of like this social drink that people are having led to this urge to create something new, something healthy, something that would help not just be sweet and sugary, but also aid your health and energy and be addictive slightly.
Only slightly.
So by the time we get to this period in the late 1980s, Matt, I was going to ask how the companies choose the stars, but also, are the stars doing it just for the dollar?
Recording companies and distributors make way more money on the sales of music than the artists themselves do. So no doubt, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that financial elements were the strongest reason. I think that probably each of them also had historical affection, right? I mean, you know, Tom, you're like, it takes me back to being 9 years old, right? And that, I'm sure for some of them, there was an element of that as well. They had an affection for either Coke or Pepsi. Supposedly Michael Jackson was approached by Coca-Cola. Possibly the reason he didn't say yes to them on a couple of occasions was because he was a Pepsi fan and was kind of waiting, hoping that Pepsi might reach out to him.
When you, Katie, have watched some of these adverts back in the past few days, what have your thoughts been? Because I watched the George Michael Diet Coke one. And we're familiar with the sort of the career arc of George Michael, where he leaves Wham and he releases Faith, and then he gets rid of it and he wants to get rid of that whole image. In the advert, he is never more George Michael Faith or Faith George Michael than in this advert, because he's got the cowboy boots. He's got a massive set of spurs on both cowboy boots. He's got the tight jeans. He's got a cropped jacket with a lot of rhinestone going on. It's the antithesis of Listen Without Prejudice, which will be the next, you know, when he strips it back down.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, so it's almost like caricature.
Yeah, like he's doing the cartoon version of himself. I guess when I was looking at the Michael Jackson Pepsi one, and that's one where he's sort of benignly mentoring a young person as opposed to the other version of whatever he was up to, possibly, allegedly, I don't know. Although I did see him with some children once at a mall in Las Vegas, and I said hello to him. That was fun. Anyway, but when I saw the Pepsi ad and he's sort of encouraging the young people to do some Michael Jackson moves, I felt like it was very anodyne and safe. And I mean, I don't want to say sellout, because it's not like Michael Jackson was ever going to be some sort of edgy, niche artist or anything. But it felt like in order to satisfy the master, which is the corporation of Pepsi, he was also having to kind of just bland out his art a little bit. And I'm wondering if these artists, whether it was Tina Turner or Madonna, George Michael or Michael Jackson, did they have any reservations about throwing their lot in, or were they just after the filthy lucre?
Nothing I have come across talks about their angst. Again, as I was talking back with Coca-Cola, like The Who, David Bowie. I mean, the Rolling Stones have done. I mean, the history of music involved in these brands, particularly Coca-Cola and then Pepsi, right? It gave them permission in a way not to feel like they were sellouts. And I think because of the social nature, right? Why are these? They're just, it's sugar water. These are multi-billion-dollar businesses, you know, global, like the biggest, literally the biggest brands in the world. And it's just selling sugar water. And yet it's this ethos and this lifestyle. And it's because it's a particular product that we consume in all sorts of settings and at all times of day. And it creates that social vibe, and music is highly social. And I think that it's like, where are there these fits, right? When we talk a lot about how do brands work with lifestyle issues, you got to have a fit. The brand needs to be able to speak to that lifestyle it's trying to portray. And, you know, cola and music just seem to go together really nicely.
This is a paid advertisement from BetterHelp Therapy Online. I've got a question for you. How is your social battery feeling right now? Because it can be easy to ignore how we're feeling and sometimes spread ourselves too thin. You know what it's like. Social gatherings are starting to pick up pace after the long drag of winter. But what's the right amount of socializing for you, and how do you recharge? Well, therapy can help give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. So if you're thinking of exploring these areas and starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try.
With over 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/WDSTF for We Didn't Start the Fire. That's betterhelp.com/WDSTF. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Always fresh and never frozen, each meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. I eat flexitarian, so with a weekly menu of 35 options, there's plenty for me to choose from. So last night, I had the Moroccan-style almond-crusted salmon, and it was absolutely delicious. These are no-fuss, no-mess meals. Factor eliminates the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Simply heat and savour the good stuff. With over 60 add-ons like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and smoothies, there's plenty of options to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. Plus, you can customise your weekly meals and pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. What are you waiting for? Head to factormeals.com/WDSTF50 and use the code WDSTF50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code WDSTF50 at factormeals.com/WDSTF50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Which of the artists involved in this case are you most surprised by? Because I've been looking at the David Bowie stuff.
Yeah.
And considering how we think of Bowie now, the fact that he released a single that you could get called Coca-Cola Planet, and that the advert featured a very Bowie silhouette of him draining one of the quintessential glass bottles, I find that slightly shocking.
Well, the thing about David Bowie is that he was always a very canny artist and always had his eye on the prize. I don't think that he was totally happy to push boundaries, but he was also completely happy to have a hit. That's why he brought in our man Nile Rodgers to zhish up the album that became Let's Dance, because he wanted a hit. So he wasn't backwards and coming forward on wanting success like that.
Put on your red shoes and dance the blues.
There's a documentary where Niall's interviewed, and he talks about why did you come to me, and he's like, what do you want me to do here, right, knowing that his style of music that he'd been producing and what David had been doing was not a natural match. And he said, I want you to do what you do. Make me hits.
That's right. Make me hits.
Now, Bowie, that's not, he has several different ads over the course of his life. His entry into the soda advertising is more, you know, was later, but he's kitsch. And I think that worked for, right? That's the thing. David Bowie's, right, this universal. David Bowie and Prince are these unique, universally loved by everyone and all. It's like they could not fail. Anything they did, they gave sort of class and credit to, partly because they were also iconically not blending into what was standard at the time, and it gave them permission. But we're so pop, right? We're so such great, catchy melodies and tunes that they, again, it's these unique things where you get these permissions to do this stuff. The Who for me is but they did a whole, like The Who sells out, right? They did a whole album spun off of a couple of these commitments they made. But again, right, you got to feel sympathy. Music artists generally make their money from touring, which is a brutal day in, day out lifestyle to lead. So opportunities like this to just sit around for a day and do a recording of something and make a few million bucks, hundreds of thousands, maybe back and up to millions, as we're talking about the 80s and 90s. Just how could you turn that down?
And also the thing is, and you touched on this before, these are two iconic brands. And so in fact, it elevates an artist, I would have thought, in a way to align themselves with something that is just seen as part of American culture and part of the American dream. And I'm wondering, do you think that Coke and Pepsi would have become the iconic brands that they are without advertising?
I don't think any brand can become iconic. I'll give Starbucks as a possible exception without advertising, right? We're talking about you literally can find a few brands ever in the history who have become iconic without advertising. So yes, very commonplace. I mean, their initial spread, right? What made them popular over the course of their first couple of decades to be available, not just throughout the US, but very quickly globally, I think was because of sort of the soda fountain chemist, pharmacist background to this, right? You know, Pemberton developed Coca-Cola, but he died shortly after creating it and sold it to a wholesale pharmacist. And so he had these connections throughout all these pharmacies around the Georgia area, but as well outside of that. And so that sort of spread, that sort of that origin of these brands coming out of the soda fountain, the pharmacy, and then eventually bottlers who were doing other things and saw the way these things were popular, especially again, Coca-Cola having cocaine in it, small amounts, but still, you know, up until 1903, right, that initial spread across the United States that occurred within, you know, a dozen years after it came out, led to the bottling happening. And then they pushed and, you know, drinks were popular. These are, you know, people liked having a cold, refreshing drink as part of, like I said earlier, every part of your life may include a moment of release, a cheap, relatively moment of release and joy by having a sweet, cold drink. And, you know, boom, it explodes. So advertising creates that top of mind kind of thing to have people choose this weird syrupy sweet thing that doesn't have any corollary flavor that we think of in normal life. Versus something like a lemonade with carbonation in it, right? So that's where the advertising helped. That's where the connection to celebrity culture, right? One of the very first celebrity endorsements was Joan Crawford. She was a Coke celebrity endorser in 1933.
Wow.
So we need to set all this in the context of the furore over new Coca-Cola.
Oh, yeah.
In the middle of the 1980s. Talk us through that.
Generally, for most of their time period up until today, Coca-Cola, dominant leader. And up until about 1970, very dominant leader, like 5-1. So all of that going on, Pepsi is this challenger brand, right, throughout the whole time, leading into this sort of shift that goes on as they come up with this idea of doing the Pepsi Challenge. The idea was particularly in Dallas. They were seeing in Texas, their market share was horrible. One of the worst step for a very large state in the US, their worst market share. And that was sort of the implication was they knew, and actually if you read the stories about it, you know, Coke representatives kind of knew at the time too, if you just tasted the two blind, people liked Pepsi better. A little bit, not everyone, right? Everyone has different, but it was, you know, 60-40, 55-45, right? You guys split. That's kind of what it was with a little more Pepsi than Coca-Cola. So the Pepsi Challenge begins really the wars, right? That's really what starts Pepsi getting into the mindset of the public in a different way, seen as this battler and challenger, right? And it's successful and they're doing well. And they've spun off these live tastings and advertising about these live tastings and it becomes a buzz and the media is talking about it and on and on. Underlying that is Coke's realization, like we could be in trouble because people really do prefer the taste. And so behind the scenes, they went about 2 years is what I've read, being formulating what became this launch as new Coke. You know, they could have just done it subtly, just sort of changed yeah. the flavor, right? You guys are looked at blind taste test. You're like, which one? And they're different a little bit, but I don't know. And you, is it Coke or is it? I mean, you know, they could have subtly changed the flavor. Would people, once they saw the red, their mindset would have been, I'm drinking a Coke. And they probably would have never noticed. But they felt this need to like, have this public announcement like the Pepsi Challenge. So they made it big. And that's where you get right into the distinction between the functional elements of a product and the mindset we have about the product, right? Because the function, like flavor-wise, people, they'd done all their testing. People preferred the new Coke to the existing Coke if they did blind taste tests.
That's so interesting. So they actually liked the new Coke.
They did. That was, I mean, they tested it. They didn't do this because out of a total whim without any commitment. They had been testing this new formula. They knew people preferred it. But that moment of taking this this brand, this icon, this thing that I loved, and changing it crushed people. I mean, it became front page of the news.
It was almost like a betrayal of sorts.
That's exactly right. That is what people felt. I love your, love this product. I love who you are, and you've changed your formula. I want no part of it. I'm fine if you create Diet Coke. I mean, they had Tab for years, which we don't really talk about much, as the first diet drink. I'm okay with you adapting and creating a new thing, but somehow that thing that I bought and loved, you've changed, was anathema.
I'm so interested in the idea of the emotions that are attached to these inanimate objects. And I know it's because, you know, people, they're almost like part of the family. You know, whenever there's a gathering of the family or your friends, you're drinking one of these beverages usually. And I'm wondering if the fact that music was involved, and we're talking about these rock and roller color wars, and I mean the fact that Madonna actually debuted her Like a Prayer song and video with for Pepsi. I mean, I wonder if that was just the ultimate, do you think, in mashing together all of these emotion triggering things, whether it's music and whether it's comestibles, drinkables.
Every brand is trying to come up with something emotional to tie you into. And music had been historically a part of these pop, like any, all the brands that spent a lot of money. I mean, soap brands, all these kind of things. But like, could Aretha Franklin have done a Pepsi ad? Sure, right? Versus Coca-Cola. I don't think, there's not too much about the brands, although you could argue, right, from the core perspective, if you look at them, and it's interesting as you look at advertising over time, they mimic and copy each other.
Yeah.
One of them does a youth thing for a while. The other one does youth. One of them did, you know, had their country cowboy boots in the 50s and 60s, their cowboy boots and hats ads. And then the other one did their cowboy boots and cowboy hat ads. And so there is a lot of overlap if you actually look at it over the course of time. But we think of Coke as sort of happiness and nostalgia, you know, in our modern era, right, is where they've gone. And Pepsi as youth, young, fun, energized.
So Pepsi's looking forward and Coke is looking back, and that's broadly. So today, every dime store teen TikTok influencer styles himself as a brand, but that wasn't the case in the 1980s. And I'm wondering, did that association help Madonna and Michael Jackson? Did that, was there a boomerang effect, and did that help their careers?
Anytime you are placed in front of lots of people, you're going to get an increase in some fashion to your sales or revenue, right? So every one of these stars being on the airwaves in an additional fashion through this advertising only created more of a mindset, you know, for people to think about these artists and therefore buy their albums or request their songs, you know, from DJs on the radio.
I wonder as well, Katie, because that Madonna track, Like a Prayer, that you referenced, was actually at the time considered quite transgressive, wasn't it? Because,
of course,
you know, there is a lot of religious iconography, as there always is with Madonna, but there is the kissing of a black Jesus, which in 1989 was quite the thing.
It was quite the thing, yeah. Waxy black
crucifix.
Jesus. Yeah, well, there's a statue that comes to life in a Sleeping Beauty.
And she's sort of in jail, but not in jail. She's in a church with a gospel choir.
She's having it every which way but loose. She's like cavorting around, you know, a field of burning crosses, wearing a slut slip, and it's all very intoxicating. I'm playing with fire here, but Matt, the phony baloney culture war era that Americans are currently enjoying, I'm wondering how these two brands would position themselves or reflect the divisions happening in American culture today, because like the Madonna kissing a black Jesus would be seen as intolerably woke by the fragile white nationalist. I mean, I'd like to teach the world to sing. That would not go down very well.
Tune are you going to teach this world to sing?
No. There'd be some book banning. There'd be some problems. But how do brands like Coke and Pepsi, how do they tiptoe through the tulips with these sort of fissures that are happening in society?
Yeah, I think we see that it changes over time and even within a few years, right? The permission to tackle something in society grows and wanes and has historically in the way that Coca-Cola had a huge hit with I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing, right? At a time in which there were also people who were very angry about anti-war protests, about the civil rights movement. I mean, that was not a time when it was necessarily easy to say, hey, peace and love, right? I mean, there were a lot of angry members of the public that were angry at the time in doing that. And yet Coke turned it into a huge success. And we've seen failures of that too, right? Most recently, you're talking about it now, but the Kendall Jenner Pepsi ad that you guys may have remembered coming out. And Pepsi gained its notoriety in the 30s when it went to a 12-ounce bottle for a nickel instead of a 6-ounce bottle for a nickel, as Coca-Cola did. So the growth of Pepsi, which really had gone bankrupt twice prior to 1931, was that it tapped in with that pricing change. And so it became something that, you know, poor people bought more because it was less expensive. Spun out of that, there was a racial affection within PepsiCo, challenged at times, right? Because it was controversial, right? We don't want to be associated as the black brand of soda because maybe that'll turn off white people, right? I mean, there was that, those debates went on in the hallways of PepsiCo, but they committed more. And so I think based on that ethos over time, as you know, prior to the growing protests and the full effect we've had since pandemic, but there were, again, Black Lives Matter type protests going on. And Pepsi felt, with our history, this is a place that we can play. And, you know, they got a star, Kendall Jenner, to come and do a kind of peace and love ad. But it failed tremendously. And I think it failed tremendously in two ways. One, on execution. It was sort of cheesy. I mean, the reality was it didn't have the grit. Like, the beauty of a bunch of singers on a hillside was it was separated from a protest. Whereas the Kendall Jenner ad tried to display a protest, but in a not seemingly angsty, angry, tense way. And again, does Pepsi have the right to be commenting on this? Does Kendall Jenner, the right person to be comment, right? So, oh, it just, how did it not, how did they even put it out?
She effectively brings world peace by offering a Pepsi.
That's right, exactly. And it was sort of lambasted, and they pulled the ad really quickly because, you know, it just didn't work in the same way New Coke, right?
Talking of playing with fire, Matt, was it a Pepsi or filming a Pepsi commercial when Michael Jackson suffered those burns?
That was, yeah, round two. So the first one was this adaptation of Thriller. And the second one, I forget what the ad was called, Community or something like that. And yeah, it was pyrotechnics, lit his hair on fire, and Pepsi, you know, luckily they stamped it out. He went to the hospital. He was fine, had some surgery, although he blames his drug addiction to that incident over the long term. Didn't come out right away, but he began to talk about it. That was the first, I got painkillers, and that was sort of what led me onto the becoming a drug addict. But at the time, again, hit the news. They got lots of earned media of it, and they, you know, attention and love of Pepsi grew as much from the hair as it did from using the star in their ads.
Katie, we've discussed a lot about these two brands, and I'm just looking at the bottles on the table in front of us that we use in our blind taste test. And even the fact that one is red and one is blue separates them off, doesn't it? I just wonder, Matt, as someone who, as I've mentioned, last had either of these beverages at the age of 9, do consumers tend to be either a Coke person or a Pepsi person, or do people switch from one to the other and back again?
Again, data on this seems to be mostly people love one or the other and get angry, right? A la the new Coke, the reaction to new Coke.
I'm so fascinated by the idea that advertising is a form of not so subtle brainwashing. And I'm wondering, going forward with these brands, what do you see in how they're positioning themselves? Because, like you say, Coca-Cola seems to be largely about looking back nostalgically, and Pepsi seems to be about looking into the future. And right now, particularly in America, it's such a polarized country, and people are very interested more than ever in taking sides. It's like the whole country is having a Pepsi challenge, you know, in terms of culture wars. How do you see these brands continuing? Do you think they're going to keep on enlisting rock stars and pop stars, or are we going to move on to influencers or maybe politicians?
Oh, politicians would be fascinating. That would be a whole, the quote unquote, don't touch the third rail of just politics itself, right? Which is largely broken and exactly what we're talking about. Incorporating a politician into it would be a whole nother ballpark of things. That'd be crashing the train entirely. I don't expect either of these two brands, particularly with what happened with the Pepsi Kendall Jenner ad. I don't think either of these two brands that are essentially neutral at this point in their lives, in terms of, you know, their political ethos, are going to get onto the culture, touch the culture rail too much. They will touch pop music. They will use influencers up until, you know, what happened with Anheuser-Busch, you know, Bud Light.
Who was the trans influencer?
Well, they were, you know, again, in a thing where Bud Light's trying, recognizing that generally beer sales are going down, the society's changing, they're looking to target new stakeholders, right? New people who might be interested. And so when you do that, you pick some different themes and people that relate to those. So they were like, hey, the LGBTQ plus community, we want to adapt to that more. All they did was send a can with, you know, her picture on it. And she did one quick little moment about saying, hey, join this contest. It's cool to see my face on a can, right? This was not some national, global advertising switch. I mean, that's the level we're at, which is what makes it, you know, more impactful and trickier, right? You know, you can have a brand like Patagonia who, you know, in 2020 on the label of one of their products, which of course went viral via social media, had "vote the assholes out" on their tag. You know, Patagonia is a beloved brand by both Republicans and Democrats. But again, that could have been controversial. That could have gotten Republicans to start burning Patagonia, but went fine. That was fine. Why did Patagonia could do that? I think Coca-Cola and Pepsi, because their ethos is social, being together,
yes,
being happy, both of them, fun, happiness, socialization, like that's what they're about. The lifestyle of your everyday fun life. And I don't think either of them are going to get too deep into the culture wars at this point.
So throughout this entire song, Billy travels the world. He travels across countries, across cataclysmic events, reviews various world leaders, their successes, their failures, their crimes. And it occurs to me that Coca-Cola in particular is really a symbol of America. And do you know, Matt, if it still carries a cachet or kind of like a Statue of Liberty torch of hope in other countries? Because it used to be kind of Coke and Mickey Mouse were the two symbols of America that sort of symbolized democracy and freedom.
Yeah, I think we're past that now. I mean, I think we're past that mostly because, right, the world, as the internet came and the world went from being a large place to a quote unquote small place, right, where no matter where you were around the world, your message could get out there and become something that everyone around the world knew about, that separation of sort of iconic brands representing a national symbol, they're still place branding. There are brands that are tied to the place they are in. I think Coca-Cola is still tied into America as a brand, despite the fact that it's been global for over 100 years now. But doesn't have the sense of sort of freedom, maybe, that it would have, I think, because brand America is undergoing its challenges right now in the global marketplace. So brands strongly associated with America have lost that kind of cachet. The power of the American brand has dipped. So,
well, Casey, you've made me think there when you talk about Coca-Cola as a representation of all that America has been and can be. So actually it feels really quite a fitting topic for our final episode.
I think so too. Matthew Quint, thank you so much for being such a fantastic storyteller and putting a little muscle and sinew in what I previously thought was a somewhat flaccid topic. You brought it to life.
Well, thank you so much, Katie and Tom, for having me. Congratulations on episode 120 and putting a button on what I'm sure will be an enjoyable historic look at history and pop culture for everyone over time.
You know it.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of the new Medal of Honor podcast from Evergreen Podcasts, brought to you in partnership with the National Medal of Honor Museum. In each three-minute episode, we'll learn about a different service member who distinguished him or herself through an act of valor. We'll include stories from the Civil War to Iraq and Afghanistan, and from all branches of the military. We'll talk about service members who were overlooked for the medal at first due to their race or religion, and about those who were celebrated at the time. We'll hear stories of soldiers like Audie Murphy, future Hollywood star who mounted a burning tank to hold off German infantry in World War II, and people like Dr. Mary Edwards Walker, a Civil War Army doctor and the only woman to receive the Medal of Honor so far. Learn about these heroes and more wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, Katie, this is usually the part of the show when we reflect on the single episode that we have just recorded.
Yes.
It's slightly different today.
It's a little bit different. It's kind of strange. It's bittersweet. A little bit like my Pepsi, which is which is almost finished. I am a Pepsi girl.
You're a fiend.
I am a fiend. This is our final episode. Billy saw fit to stop at topic 120, and that's it for us.
Yeah. And Casey, we have had a number of questions and topics and thoughts from our lovely listeners.
I know, the listeners are so great. They're so invested. We couldn't have done it without you guys.
Linda has asked, I like this one, what our favourite moments from the show would be.
Yeah, what are you thinking about that?
Do you know what? I was thinking back this morning to an episode where it was one of those words that, A, we couldn't say, I'm still not sure I can say it, but we definitely didn't know what it was beforehand, which was Panmunjom.
Oh, yeah.
And we had the lovely Colin Thackeray come in.
Yes.
In his full Chelsea pensioner's red tunic and sang some beautiful songs to us in the studio.
He was a veteran of the Korean War, still going strong in his 90s, looking sharp in that uniform and singing his heart out. And my gosh, what a hero. That guy was so fun. And you've just reminded me, Tom, one of the things that's so wonderful about doing this show is that we have been lucky enough to talk to some of the participants in these events, and our Berlin episode.
Oh, the love story.
The love story where she helped her future husband escape from East Berlin. It was cloak and dagger. It was total spy film stuff. It was thriller diller. And so anyone who hasn't heard that, go back and listen to that Berlin episode, because we have the couple who were reunited and the young man who helped smuggle out the future husband.
Getting a bit throat lumpy thinking about that one, Katie.
Oh, yeah.
Here is a question from George. George asks a question that we frequently ask ourselves, Katie, on our coffee breaks. Is there anything major you think was missed? I've got a little bit of a list here.
Yeah, you have a list. I know this is something that you kvetch about on from time to time. Tell me what you have on your list.
Well, I've got Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
First and foremost, I've got Muhammad Ali. We get quite a few boxers, but we don't get the most iconic boxer of all time. And think about Muhammad Ali, is there are so many different ways you could get him in. You could get him in as Cassius Clay when he's winning Olympic gold and beating Sonny Liston. You could get in the anti-Vietnam War protests. You could get any number of epic sporting contests. I wonder too, Katie, we obviously had our Beatles reference with the lovely Mark Lewisohn.
Yeah.
You probably could have squeezed in more Beatles ones as the biggest and greatest band of all time. You probably, in a very sad note, might have referenced the assassination of John Lennon in 1980.
Yeah.
And maybe, thinking about all things music in the 80s, as you and I like to do a lot of the time.
Yes, we do.
Where the hell is Live Aid?
Yeah, Live Aid isn't in there. Was Billy asked
well,
to bring... Okay.
Billy didn't appear at Live Aid. Here's what he says about it, Katie. I was going to participate in Live Aid.
Yeah.
I just couldn't get all the guys in my band together.
Oh, yeah.
And I tell you, to go out in a stadium and just play the piano is a little bit rough. So maybe that's why Live Aid doesn't get a mention.
Yeah, that's... I don't know how plausible that is. That's like me going, I was going to play Live Aid too. I was, and then I just felt like, you know, I couldn't get the band together. Really? Really, Billy? Yeah, I'm not sure. Okay, so my big question mark, be in my bonnet moment, is why the heck did Billy leave out Andy Warhol? I think there should have been more art in there. And Andy Warhol is somebody who touches all manner of pop culture in the 60s. He sort of single-handedly invented people as a brand. He invented reality television, the way he would just turn the camera on and point it at the proto-influencers who styled themselves as superstars in his factory. Yeah, I think Andy Warhol would have been a good moment, a good episode.
Definitely. Question from Nigel. In fact, I'm going to read Nigel and Roger's questions together because I think they may end up combining in our minds.
Mm.
Nigel's question, favourite episode and favourite guest. Roger's question, which episode surprised you the most?
Okay, so yeah, hi Nigel. I loved our Einstein guest.
David Badanis.
Fun to say, fun to listen to. So passionate, so fun-loving. Not surprised to find out that he used to be a children's television host.
I think you took a slight shine to him over the course of the episode.
I do sort of slightly fall in love with all of our guests. I get a little bit of a crush on them because I love anyone who has a big brain and who is excited about their topic.
Excellent choice, Katie. I would also throw in, I think, as favourite guests, I always loved it when we had Margaret McMillan on.
Oh, yeah. Talk about crush. I mean, and talk about a big brain. She's somebody who is well across her subject. She was H-bomb and she was the queen as well.
England's got a new queen.
She just knows her stuff. Oh, and what about her lovely nephew?
Mr. Dan Snow.
Okay. So I have a crush on him as well. Basically, doing this podcast is a chance for me just to have like heart eyes at everybody who's so smart and interesting.
I think he was our
including
first...
Including you.
Thank you, Katie. I think he was our first guest to come to the studio in shorts as well. Katie, it would be remiss at this point not to mention Dr. Kara Robway.
Oh, she's the champion. She's done the most episodes of any of our experts.
And we also need to give a shout out, of course, on that same topic to Josh Chetwynd.
Oh, Josh.
Picked you up and carried you through the battlefield that is baseball.
You know what? I still wake up in the middle of the night feeling a little bit bad that I gave him a hard time, and I hope he's not waking up in the middle of the night cursing my name. But I used to kind of pretend that I wasn't that interested in baseball, and I think I was sort of over-egging that dramatic performance because he always made it so interesting.
Yeah. Question from Bobby, Katie. Any underrated episodes that everyone needs to listen to? We always think of a certain polyester fabric.
Yes, why is Dacron? It's so compelling. and of course, it was Dr. Kara Rodway. So she's always going to be putting the pep in the step. She's going to be putting the tiger in the tank of any episode that you might be tempted to overlook. But Dacron, there's just something about the idea of better living through chemistry, the idea that World War II was over and life in America was going to be nirvana, and fabric that you never had to wash ever again was going to help us achieve that.
So, Katie, this is the plan. We have reached the end of 120 episodes of We Didn't Start the Fire, so we're finishing for now, but maybe we're just pausing. Who knows what's going to happen in the future? You and I may be back together again on air sooner than people think.
Keep your
eyes peeled. Keep your ears open to this feed.
I would keep your ears and other body parts just clamped to your device, just in case we just pop up.
And before then, we want to offer A huge thank you. We want to thank our listeners, Katie. We want to thank anyone who's ever emailed us.
Thank
anyone
you.
Anyone who sent us letters.
Thank you.
The ones who sent us aprons.
Thank you.
Those who have given us guest suggestions or come on the show.
Oh, yes. Thank you for that.
James, whose wife gave him fire-themed Christmas presents because, in his words, he wouldn't shut up about the podcast.
Well, I'm going to thank James's wife, not James, for that.
I like it. Guy, who set up a Wikipedia page just for the show, updates it every week.
He's a saint. He's a hero.
Crowd Network, all our producers, Fionn and Anna.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, looking lovingly at them through the window, blowing kisses. And a huge thank you from Tom Fordyce and Katie Puckrick to Billy Joel.
Billy, some people doubted you. Occasionally, Katie and I doubted you. I doubt you no longer. Billy, you had no idea what you were setting us loose on. And it has been fantastic. So, Billy, thank you. And, Katie, there is one other person I would like to thank.
Oh, okay.
And that is Katie Puckrick.
Oh.
And I've got you a little something to say thanks for sitting with me for 120 episodes.
Oh.
I'm passing it over to you now.
Okay.
Because I'm a man, I haven't wrapped it. It's simply in the envelope that it arrived
it's
in.
It's a brown cardboard, unmarked envelope, and I'm pulling it out. And it's a 45 record of We Didn't Start the Fire by a man named Billy Joel. And this is a very, very thoughtful record. And this is a very thoughtful present to give me. But I'm wondering if the other box that you haven't shown me yet has a record player in it. Because I don't have one.
Well, Katie, I thought that we knew the song well enough that you didn't actually need to play it anymore. But now you've got your own Billy Joel, We
thank
Didn't
you.
Start the Fire, keepsake forevermore.
Oh, thank you. It's just been such a pleasure working with you, and it's only the beginning.
And we have got something else for you, Katie, as well, which Fionn is just bringing into the studio, a small envelope. And I'm glad you said what you said a little while ago. If you just want to pull that envelope open and describe to the listeners what you are seeing.
Okay, so this is fantastic. So this is a greeting card. It has a drawing of Andy Warhol in front of his Marilyn Monroe triptych, and he's saying, WTF, Billy! And notes from Fionn and Anna, our stalwart producers. Aw, thank you, guys.
So, Katie, that is the end for now. Let's finish with a message from listener James. This is what James has written in. James says, I worry what I'll do when the fire part of my life ends.
Me too.
Well, let me just say, I have already realised I will just go back to episode one and start again.
Easy.
James says, thanks again for a great show. It's been a great pleasure to share the journey with you all.
Well, you know what? Obviously, we would do this in a darkened room all on our own with a different expert every week. But the thing that makes it important and wonderful is that you all get to share it with us. So thank you for making We Didn't Start the Fire a commitment. Community and a communion.
We'll see you all soon.
Bye.
Crowd Network.
A place where you belong.
Our lives were never the same after we learned our 21-year-old daughter, Kristen, was murdered by her ex-boyfriend. It's a parent's worst nightmare. How much did we really know about domestic violence back then? Clearly not enough. Now we know plenty. We know domestic violence, or DV, can happen to anyone. One in three women suffer physical violence at the hands of intimate partners during their lifetimes. One in three. I'm Bill Mitchell, host of the When Dating Hurts podcast. And my interviews with DV counselors, law enforcement, and especially actual DV survivors give the pandemic of domestic violence the attention it deserves. The When Dating Hurts podcast. It's a series of lives being saved.
Hello, this is Gary Chahot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.